Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. I would like to open an organizational meeting. With that, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the proposed committee rules.
So moved.
All right. Senator Morissette has moved that we adopt the proposed committee rules that are dated 2009 session. So is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I didn't see anything in the rules that were the penalties for having your cell phone turned on. It was usually $5 for pizza.
Right. I'm sorry. The Secretary of the Senate didn't feel that that was a necessary thing to into the rules.
Okay. Can we make it an ad hoc rule that someone will remember?
That we will remember,
thank you.
Yes.
Did you turn your phone off?
Yes, is your phone off?
I've got mine on buzz, which is acceptable.
Oh. Okay. So it's not off, though. Technically, you're in violation.
Well, technically. I can't because I have another job.
Okay. That's fine.
Well, if there are no objections, I hear no objections, then motion carries and the rules are adopted. And now I will close the organizational meeting, and I'll open an informational meeting. And colleagues, workforce, we had a presentation, very brief presentation on workforce in the interim, but we had some new members here, and Senator Morse and Senator Bates hadn't actually heard that, although I know Senator Bates is extremely aware of that. But I think we need to start with our workforce issues in knowing where we need to go this session with the healthcare workforce area. So with that, and also I want to apologize. Senator Cruz had scheduled another meeting. He didn't know I was going to be so well organized that I was going to be able to have one of our meetings this Thursday, but we have a huge agenda for this session, and I want to be able to process and go as quickly as possible. We are meeting on Monday, and there are bills that we're actually going to be hearing. I think we're hearing four.
Tuesday.
I always think Tuesday, four or five bills that we are actually going to be hearing. So I think those will be posted when?
Late tonight.
So with that, any comments? And Senator Morse had a constituent meetings, but he should be here in about 10 or 15 minutes. So with that, is there any comments from Senator Morissette or Senator Bates? No. All right. With that, let's start with a presentation on the shortage, the healthcare professional shortage, and let's call, shall we just follow the order here?
Exactly.
Okay, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and Joe Iskrig.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Anderson and committee members. My name is Joe Iskrig. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. And very briefly, just a background on the institute. We were developed out of an initiative out of the governor's office. Thank you. And in 2005 and in 2007 received our 501c3 designation. It's a public-private partnership with members from industry, education, public policy, workforce, and many different arenas, very passionate about healthcare workforce issues, coming together to develop a high-quality healthcare workforce for to improve the health of every Oregonian. In part of advancing our solutions, we conduct healthcare workforce studies, convene stakeholders to develop solutions, make policy recommendations, look at barriers to educational admissions and clinical capacity issues, promote the use of finite resources through distance distributed education and telemedicine services, share best practices and make sure that good information is shared so that others can replicate successful programs. And then also working on identifying some of the workforce that would be needed for healthcare reform efforts as they're coming down the pike and in discussion. We've also identified four targeted areas in addition to our roles and projects that we're working on. One is, of course, to look at the physician workforce shortage and ways to address that. Second, to bring in more bicultural, bilingual, and minority workers into the healthcare workforce, address our mental health provider shortfalls, particularly for our rural areas, through telemedicine. And then one I'll speak a little bit more on later on in my presentation, and that's building our health IT and informatics workforce. To tee up this discussion with my colleagues on this panel, I wanted to give you kind of the overall industry perspective, particularly in light of the economy, so that you have a sense of where healthcare is in terms of the industry and employment. When we look at the pie of the job market for Oregon's employment, healthcare makes up about 9%. And let me just point out that government healthcare workers are covered in the pie shape for in government. They're back in 18%. So those who work for the VA or local state government who are healthcare providers are actually covered in that government number. This hasn't changed much. The percentages of the pie haven't changed much since the first of the year, and November 2008 is the last collected information that's available from the Oregon Employment Department. When we look at that particular healthcare sector of the industry, most of our healthcare workers are employed in the ambulatory healthcare services, doctor's office, dentist's office, diagnostic centers, outpatient clinics, labs, dialysis centers, hospice, home health, and hospitals. Also want to make note of that is that while they make up about 1% of the businesses in healthcare, they employ about 35% of the healthcare workforce. So shortages certainly have a significant effect on hospitals. And then finally, nursing and residential care facilities, the third sector making up that, that industry. What's interesting about this chart is that you can see it still, with the exception of the nursing and residential care, which has just a little wave in there, this line is trending upwards versus other industries that have some downward trends. So there's still growth in this particular area. So as we have growth, we still have shortages as well. And some information coming from the Office of Economic Analysis, the Oregon Employment Department, and elsewhere is that despite the recession, we're expected to see job growth in 2009. And in fact, you see in business clips that there are additional medical office buildings and clinics being developed and built, and certainly the Kaiser Hospital out in Hillsboro is still progressing forward. That growth is attributed to our aging population, our growing population, and we have some numbers showing that we have a larger number of non-elderly living with chronic health conditions as well. A couple other points with looking at the overall industry with regards to our healthcare workforce is that in a study conducted by the Oregon Employment Department in May showed that across the state, in a survey of over 10,000 employers, 1 in 5 job vacancies in the state are in healthcare. So again, that's supporting that the statement that there is indeed a shortage.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, Senator Morset.
Thank you. There's an Echo Northwest survey that will be coming out next week dealing with the possible shortage of healthcare workers or losing approximately 10 to 11,000 jobs in the field. And these are people who service adult foster homes and residential care and in-home care and so on due to proposed cuts in the governor's budget. If the 18% is levied, the 18% cut in Health and Human Services actually takes place, there's upwards of 11,000 jobs that will be lost. And I don't, you know, so I suggest that you take a look at that report when it comes out, because that's significant. Now, that's the governor's proposed budget. I hope that the legislature will make some adjustments to that and save some of those jobs so the poorest of the poor and our most needy citizens can receive services.
Great, thank you. Thank you
that's another thing that I should mention at the beginning. I'm extremely honored to have this committee. I truly am. And Senator Morissette is chair of the Human Services and Rural Health, is that your title? And then I'm also honored to have Senator Bates, who is chair of the subcommittee on health and on ways and means. And this is extremely important. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, in terms of the Employment Department survey, of course, registered nurses had the highest number of vacancies within of all occupations across the state. So just to share that. A couple of issues I wanted to share with you when we look at the workforce shortage issues is our data. And we look at employment data coming from the Oregon Employment Department, and which is fed up into the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This information is based on employer reported those positions covered by unemployment insurance and the reports that come into the state with regards to those particular policies. So some of these numbers that you see here don't represent those who might be self-employed or those who cross over from locum tenens jobs. But what we can see from their data that came out in November 2007 is that there's still an upward trend in terms of these particular positions and growth. The next round of this information will come out in November 2009, so we can see any changes. But what I wanted to share with you is that we have such a great need for accurate data when we're working on workforce shortages issues, and have some examples to share with you. The Oregon Medical Board has over 15,000 licensed physicians in Oregon, and of that number, over almost 11,000 are active physicians. They have active license. Nearly 4,200 of those have identified themselves as being in primary care specialties. Half of these physicians in this active license workforce are over 50 years of age. The issue with the data here is that while the medical board shows us that we have nearly 11,000 active licensed physicians, a 2006 study from the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research showed that there were just over 8,100 active licensed physicians working in Oregon from their survey, and an OED survey in 2006 showing physicians and surgeons showed just over 6,700. There's a big difference in data when we're looking at the number of patients that can be cared for by a single physician when we look at such a broad range. And again, the same with physicians assistants. There's not quite 800 PAs on record, with 317 practicing in primary care as they self-identified, and there's the OED has identified a need for 48 new positions or new physicians assistants a year. So what we see is that we have a trend, but we don't really know exactly how many are working providing direct clinical care, if they're working full-time or part-time, and exactly where the practices are. So the same with dentists and dental hygienists as well. Again, not sure where they're working, not sure what settings they're working in, full-time, part-time, exactly what their specialties or subspecialties might be in. And that's where we really need to have this need for accurate data. Over the course of the last year, the Senate Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform and Senator Morse requested OE to convene the executive directors of the health licensing boards to create a work plan to collect workforce data on our active clinical workforce via the licensing process. And so that was identified as kind of the logical venue to do that, because everybody who's practicing needs to have a license in particular areas. So the group came together and developed a work plan that's reflected in Senate Bill 11 now, that has a phase-in project process targeting the key shortage areas and coinciding with some of the renewal, and then several of them are developing online applications, so there's some cost efficiencies to add some questions in on their process now while they're in development. It's also to provide authority for the boards to collect the information and to protect the confidentiality and minimize the burdens of the licensees as well.
So is this plan based on the nurses? The Oregon Center for Nursing has done an excellent job over the past, well, the nursing leadership has, so their data is quite accurate, I believe. You're nodding your head.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. They were, in this group, in addition to the executive directors of the licensing boards or their representatives, we had representatives there from the Oregon Board of Nursing and the Oregon Center for Nursing behind me, who helped. I mean, they really have the gold standard for our state in terms of as doing this as part of the licensing process and the information that's collected. They've been doing this since 2001. They have really good trend data. They've been able to show you and others very good, reliable data about the workforce shortage, and then using that same data to address the success of some of the programs that they have. And I know that Dr. Campbell will be talking about that shortly. There are other states who are doing this as well: North Carolina, New York, Florida, California, and Washington has done some a survey recently. So there's been others using this same process as well. But for our state, the Board of Nursing and the Oregon Center for Nursing really has the gold standard for that model.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
I hate to be the harbinger of bad news, but we are one of 12 states in the nation that has no medical malpractice cap. That's bad news in some ways. Now, we make up for that by giving assistance to certain physicians in rural Oregon to pay their medical malcap insurance, but we're about to run out of money. And unless we continue this program and propose something this session, we will run out of money and we will lose physicians. And I know of one physician that said that if they lose that assistance, they're not only leaving the state, they're leaving the country. They're going to go to Costa Rica to practice. So that is a crisis situation for rural Oregon. These are physicians that deal with the OBGYNs and so on and so forth. So that's a crisis situation coming up. Just a reality check.
Chair Mona Sanderson, thank you, Senator Morissette. We'll certainly be watching that. But there are certainly a lot of issues affecting physician practices, so that's good to know. Thank you.
Well, and that includes the nurse population, too. The right. Nurse practitioners are covered by that.
Thank you. Just in continuing on, this is something I wanted to alert you. In addition to the clinical shortages that you are aware of now, I wanted to alert you to this growing and emerging and evolving workforce issue that's coming down the pike. With the economic stimulus package at the federal level includes, or there's talk that there's a proposed $50 billion included in that for implementing a health IT record or an electronic health record for every U.S. resident within five years. And that includes the structures that need to be in place as well as the information network. That's a lot of work and a lot of workforce that's going to be needed to put that together. One estimate of those dollars is that anywhere from 38 to 64 cents of every dollar is going to be needed or would be applied for labor costs. And then another study showed that for every $10 billion investing in computerized health care and related IT, that creates over 200,000 jobs nationally as well. And then a study out of OHSU showed that just with regards to the health IT professionals, there's another 40,000 that's needed in addition to what we currently have to reach the full benefits of health IT. Well, what I wanted to share with you is that actually Oregon is positioned to be a leader in developing this particular workforce from our community colleges. We have four community colleges in particular working on addressing health IT programs and curriculum. The Oregon Institute of Technology has their new program that just enrolled their first students this last fall. And then OHSU is actually nationally and internationally known for its health IT and informatics training program there. So we're positioned.
So what four community colleges are?
Rogue, Lane, Mount Hood, and Portland Community College.
Madam Chair, yeah. My committee will be traveling to Douglas County to look at that particular
Wonderful.
IT program.
Wonderful. So, again, this is really going to create the tipping point where those programs are going to be very important to the healthcare industry. So that's wonderful. The other opportunity that exists here is to cross-train and re-employ those IT, computer science, engineering, electronics technicians from other industries who have been recently laid off into the healthcare industry, into the healthcare field. Some of those easily cross over, and some just need some slight training or additional training related to the healthcare workforce. So I wanted to alert you to that as well.
I was talking with a nurse who works here in Salem, and she's saying that with unemployment, they are now laying off nurses. When we have a shortage, it just seems ironic that they're now laying off nurses. So, have you heard that, or
I've heard that there is talk about some of those things, and I it's probably best that I let Dr. Campbell answer some of those questions. But overall, then when we look at workforce for any particular position, where one program or one business may be shutting down, there's vacancies in other areas. So that's what we have to look at, when there's a difference between an individual and their particular job and where they live versus kind of the workforce industry issues. But I'll certainly let Dr. Campbell address that one as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. And now I'd like to call up Sarah Hopkins-Powell from Pacific University. She's the Executive Dean and Vice Provost of Health Professions. And while she's coming up, I am remiss in not introducing our administrator and our committee assistant. Bob Shook is new to this area but has a very excellent background in healthcare, and I want to welcome you. And then Cassandra, is it Stock?
Yes.
Strock, who will be our committee assistant. And so thank you. We're going to have a really good, productive session. All right.
Good morning, Senator Motors Henderson and committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Sarah Hopkins-Powell, and I'm the Executive Dean of the College of Health Professions at Pacific University. We think we're one of the best-kept secrets in Oregon, unfortunately, or fortunately, about what we do. Just a couple words about Pacific. We were founded in 1849, and we were founded to serve the orphans of the Oregon Trail and the Native Americans in western Washington County. So we've had a long history of service, even though we're a private institution, to really meet needs of the people in this area. We began our health professions education in 1945 with the acquisition of a local optometry program. We've graduated over 4,000 graduates in that program. About 21% are still practicing in Oregon. It is the only optometry program in the state, and probably the program that Pacific is best known for. There are only 17 optometry schools in the entire country, so there's an issue there, and there are some more schools coming on, but it is a relatively small training ground for optometrists. In the 1960s, Pacific began to add additional programs at the baccalaureate level. Both physical therapy and occupational therapy were added in the 60s and 70s. Physical therapy is now a doctorate. It's a doctorate of physical therapy. It's a clinical doctorate. Occupational therapy is still a master's program, but it will probably also become a doctorate. And Pacific has the only PT and OT programs in the state of Oregon. And so despite the large number of the demand for these programs, I'll talk a little bit about why there still aren't other programs developing and what some of the challenges are to train additional people in PT and OT as we move forward. In the 1990s, we added the Physician Assistant Studies Program. This is a master's degree. We and OHSU have the two PA programs in the state of Oregon. We also have professional psychology, which includes a master's and a doctorate, and we have one of the few bilingual bicultural training programs in psychology. And also, since your committee also looks at veteran affairs, we do have a contract with Washington County to provide bilingual bicultural counseling services to veterans in Washington County. In 2006, we added a pharmacy program, which is a PharmD. We are the other program in the state with Oregon State University. We will graduate our first class this spring, and in a couple of years, we will be doubling the number then of pharmacists who are trained every year. We also added in 2006 a Dental Health Science Baccalaureate program. The other program is at OIT. This is a program that had existed at OHSU in the School of Dentistry and was closed for a variety of reasons, and we essentially took a lot of that energy around that program and reopened it. It has a focus on public health and rural practice. And this last year, we started a Master's of Healthcare Administration because as we move into new reform areas, we're going to need additional leaders to really lead us through a lot of these changes. These are the number of students that are admitted for each of the programs. These programs, except for the psychology program, are cohort programs in the sense that each year we admit, in the case of occupational therapy, 30 students. Those 30 students complete the 3 years together. it's a very lockstep kind of model in all these programs. In general, the first year of these programs is a didactic year. Classroom experience is pretty much with some shadowing in the field. And then the second and third year, the students are in more and more in clinical practice and less in classroom practice. So it varies a little bit by program, which is one of the things we say in my building, is that everything varies by program a little bit, but that's generally the way these programs are run. The number of graduates at the master's level, one of the reasons that this graph changes is because the physical therapy program went from a master's degree to a doctorate. And so you can see there has been some growth, but not a lot. I do want to say that both with physical therapy and occupational therapy, they were really impacted by the Balanced Budget Act. And when Medicare does not reimburse for PT and OT, it really affects the number of students then that are interested in those programs if there aren't any jobs. And those jobs went away really quickly. And so PT has come back as that was reversed, but OT has been slower to come back as a field. But we are seeing some increasing numbers across the country. And these are the numbers of doctoral students. You can see the larger blue is the physical therapy doctorate, and the green is the clinical psychology.
Would it be possible for us to get copies
yes,
of that?
Yes. In fact, I forgot to put those with your packets that you've got, but I have them.
Sure.
Yes.
Question?
Senator Bates.
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, could you give us a, not now, but later, show us the funding streams for these various programs through what individuals pay and through the Medicare programs for graduate training?
We get very little money from the Medicare graduate, almost none except in optometry. And just briefly, the funding is primarily from student tuition.
Well, I'd like to see what those numbers are, if you would, please.
And the student tuition runs from $26,000 a year to $34,000 a year for pharmacy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And are there grants, scholarships?
There are very few. Most of the students get federally subsidized loans and then unsubsidized loans, which is one of the challenges as we move forward. Oops, let me go back. Let me just say that a lot of this varies by program where the students come from. Dental hygiene tends to be more of a more local market. Pharmacy, we're recruiting from across the country. And physical therapy, about a third of the students are from Oregon. Because of the shortages nationwide, students apply for these programs from a variety of places. This year we had over 900 applications for 40 slots in the physician assistant program. Because there's a national application, people apply from all over. So there really is it's a slightly different applicant pool for each of the programs. As I mentioned, pharmacy will have its first graduating class in 2009. We've really made an effort. A focus in this program is rural practice. The students have been doing clinical rotations in rural practice. It's one of the things we've really focused on for pharmacy. In physical therapy, 80% of our students still practice in Oregon. You saw in optometry, only 21% of the graduates are still practicing in Oregon. Again, it just varies. Each of the disciplines is slightly different.
Thank you very much. Now, rural Oregon, that are you talking about statewide rural or just concentrated rural?
Statewide rural.
Okay, thank you.
And we do send our students on clinical rotations, as this says, from Wheeler to Klamath Falls to Baker City. We do work, the students do clinical rotations, which is a big predictor in all healthcare about where students will ultimately practice. So we make sure that their clinical rotations are in a variety of settings, including rural and community health centers.
Good.
And this just shows you where our students are practicing across.
If I had waited just a minute, I could.
You could see that it's across the state. So let me get to what I think is really the meat of the question today, and that is, what are the challenges as we move forward? All of these programs basically rely on an apprenticeship model for training. That is, that they spend the first year or so in a classroom setting, and then they're working with mentors in the field, and they're learning then in those settings. And so we rely on those practice settings to supervise the students. And as we're sort of in this chicken and egg, because as there is a shortage of people in the field, then those settings are less willing to take our students. And so we really get into this circular sort of model. Nursing, I think, has really broken through this a little bit with some different ways to do clinical. It's going to be a slightly larger challenge to do it with all of these programs, but that's a real problem for us in terms of expanding our programs immediately, is finding enough clinical rotation sites. Our students already are go from Alaska to Texas to find the clinical training sites that they need. There just aren't enough that we can rely on predictably to be able to do that. We do not pay for our sites. There are schools in the East who pay a lot for their clinical training sites. We have not, in the West, we're still not quite there yet. So this is one of the challenges to these programs. People look at our numbers. We admit 40 students in physical therapy. Why can't you make that 80? Well, all those students have to go through at least 6 to 8 clinical rotations. And so finding those sites in nursing homes, hospitals, with qualified mentors is a challenge for us. Finding faculty, this is a common thread in all healthcare education, is difficult. If we get 1 to 3 applications for a faculty vacancy in one of our programs, that's a lot. That we think 3 is a big number. Contrast that, my previous history was at Southern Oregon University. If we had a vacancy in English, we could get 300 to 500 applications for a position. So you really have a very limited faculty pool. One of our challenges is, as these jobs have become more scarce, salary has increased. So for people to come into teaching, they will take generally a salary cut to come into the education setting. Another challenge for us is that all of these programs are accredited nationally by a separate accrediting agency. Each of them also has slightly different criteria about what the practitioners have to do, what kinds of clinical rotations they have to do, the kinds of projects they have to do. All of those things are just enough different that they can drive you crazy. But the accrediting agencies are set up that the students have to graduate from, the state requires that students graduate from accredited programs before they can sit for the licensing exams. So there is, again, there's a real tie to these national organizations, and so to change how the clinical training is done, for example, is going to take some national effort to move some of that in a different direction. That's not to say that we in Oregon, as they have with nursing, can take the lead in some of these and moving how these things happen. Student challenges, as I mentioned, student financial aid is huge. These students leave with debt in excess of $200,000 to $300,000 often, combined with their undergraduate programs. And this is really of a concern to us for students from diverse backgrounds. We are involved with a number of pipeline programs trying to bring diverse students in, and we have in pharmacy and PA and dental hygiene some of the highest numbers in the country of more ethnically diverse students in our programs. But financial aid is key to that, and scholarships are key to that, and they're really aren't enough. The other problem, you'll hear from our community college colleagues, one of the problems that we've had with the change in these fields is as we move to the doctorate in physical therapy, you have to have a bachelor's degree first before you can go into physical therapy. So if you're a minority student who's a first-generation student looking, you've got to look at first your undergraduate college and then your graduate work. And there used to be, in the old days when PT was a bachelor's program, you had programs in the community colleges, 2+2 we used to call them, or 3+2. But those have essentially disappeared as these fields have become more sophisticated and the degrees have become at a higher level. So with minority students and diverse students, we have to talk to them about having the long view to get into these fields. And that's still a challenge, I think, for a lot of students to see that long view. Another thing that I think is an issue as we begin to do this, and I know that there are some bills that are going to be introduced, is just this continued issue of expanded roles, whether that's with dental hygienists or physician assistants or pharmacists. You know, that given the physician shortage, whether or not other of these professions moving into some expanded roles will help us, particularly in rural areas, I think is a real issue. One of the things that we're doing with the PA program is our specialty postgraduate residencies. We have one with Legacy Emmanuel now for emergency rural health care, and those people are coming in after they've already been trained as a PA to get extra training in emergency care, because in rural communities, that ER and that small hospital is the place where health care is often delivered. So we're looking at those things. Just a quick word. We are at Pacific trying to move into the other areas that where we have real shortages. There is not an audiology doctorate program in the state right now, and we have been we have made a commitment to look at this and hope by 2010-11 to have at least a beginning of a program moving through its accreditation process and to start a program in audiology. We had been looking at nursing education. I think that we're going to enter into some more discussions with OHSU around what's really the need in nursing and what's our best niche to fill with nursing. I mentioned the PA program. I think Pacific's commitment in all of these is to provide a focus on healthcare professionals that are committed to serving underserved populations. We have a real commitment to interprofessional education and evidence-based practice, and we want to make sure that Oregon has the healthcare practitioners that it needs as we move forward. I'll be glad to take any questions.
What would you see as the state's role in helping? What could we do besides providing money?
Well, I think that there is some work to support expanded roles. I think there is work to be done with perhaps a statewide coalition from some of the, I'm sure some of the organizations here, to work on trying to see how we can deal with this issue of the clinical training, whether that's helping hospitals and nursing homes and community health centers be able to train additional students.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Yeah, thank you. Expanding roles, I think, requires a separate body to review that before it comes to the legislature. We don't have the expertise to decide these issues, you know, whether or not psychologists should prescribe psychotropic drugs. That's coming back to us. We struggle with that every year. Someone else has to make that. Someone else has to advise us. We will make the decision.
I think you're going to get some suggestions from some of the licensing boards and the professional organizations this year, as you do frequently on some expanded roles. And I do think that they're worth, I mean, one of the things with pharmacists, for example, that I don't know that this is coming forward this year, but as we see in pharmacy, often it's the pharmacist who is the person who sees the patient the most often. If you're a diabetic patient, you may see your pharmacist more than you see any other practitioner. So beginning to look at pharmacists as case managers in some ways is one of the things that we see in the future.
May I?
Yeah.
Well, my particular pharmacist calls my doctor and says, and questions whether or not one drug will have a, and she's very good. And I think you're absolutely right. The pharmacists are in a position to play a more important role.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'll respond to one comment and I'll ask for another. Pharmacists, case managers, and diabetics, you and I can have a private discussion about that, okay?
Yes, we can.
I forget, it's totally ridiculous. They could be a big part of the team, but they don't have the expertise, knowledge, and with the time to spend with the patient that way. But you mentioned that you thought that the state could play a role in helping with residency programs and mentoring programs. What did you mean by that? I think that is a big problem, both for physicians and dentists, PAs, OTs, PTs. RTs to a certain degree too.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What were you thinking on those lines?
I think that one of the things is that we're going to need to have some kind of a major summit discussion, really, to move this forward, because on the way that the clinical training is set up is usually fairly individualistic. Mm-hmm. A physical therapist at Kaiser agrees to take one of our students. They get overwhelmed. They call us and say, not in a negative, I mean, bad way about us, but just say, sorry, we can't do that clinical rotation for that student. And what we've been trying to do with the healthcare institutions is sort of get that to a higher level, because that individual making that decision impacts a whole lot of things. So I think it's got to be the hospitals, the nursing home community, the healthcare organizations themselves in these various areas, plus OHSU, Pacific, and other providers, to really sort of come together to say, how can we solve this problem? And maybe it's looking at the model that nursing is used with more simulation and some other ways that they're trying to do the clinical. Those all are challenging, but I think it's got to be that one of the roles the state could play is really bringing people together to bring our best thinking to the table around that issue.
Well, mm-hmm. Do you see any specific barriers to clinical rotations for these people? I mean, is it a matter of not enough time for the practitioner to mentor somebody? Is it a financial burden? Is it a difficulty with housing for the people going out across the state, the students? What kind of barriers are you running into?
It's more time issues as healthcare institutions or even private practices have more challenges in terms of the pressures on them and now the financial pressures that exist. It seems that for practitioners that like to have students in their practice, suddenly to have one more thing is too much. And so I think we've got to look at some models that provide some relief for that. One of the things we're doing is, in pharmacy, we're sending groups of students, for example, to live in Southern Oregon so that they're doing all of their rotations out of Medford to Klamath Falls, to Grants Pass, so that they're sort of based there and then go out from that model. And that helps us a little bit, so that if one of those institutions can't, if Rogue Valley can't take somebody, Providence can. And so we can move people around in that environment. But it takes a lot of coordination to be able to do that across all these fields.
Thank you. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Other discussion? Okay. Thank you,
thank you
very, very much. I have a lot more questions, but we do have an agenda that I want to try to keep to, too, but this is excellent information. We're going to have Rita Cavan, who's president of Lynn Benton College, actually be the Oregon Community College healthcare representative. Oh, I forgot.
That's okay.
I went out of order, but that's all right. We'll hear you, and then we'll go with our introduction.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, may I extend personal greetings
yes.
to my friends?
Yes.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Rita Cavan, president of Lynn Benton Community College, and I'd like to introduce my colleague, Ann Malosh, who is dean of the Health Occupations and Workforce Development Division at LBCC. And I brought her as a content specialist in case you had questions that were too hard for me. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on the role of community colleges in addressing Oregon's shortages of healthcare professionals. And I thank you for your continued interest in these issues and for your past support. As you know, we work with our partners, many of whom you're hearing today, to address the predicted shortages that will face Oregon as our population ages and as more current healthcare professionals retire. In fact, Oregon Employment Department projects a need for 57,000 healthcare workers between 2006 and 2016, which is a 28% increase. The industry believes that these numbers may be understated due to the increased use of services that will occur with an aging population. Filling the current and emerging health care jobs will have a powerful economic impact on Oregon and its communities. Oregon's 17 community colleges will continue to play an important role in educating and training a large percentage of Oregon's future nursing and allied health professional students. We're making progress with the resources provided to us by the legislature, but we have a long way to go to meet the demand of all regions of Oregon. We have prepared a document for you that outlines the current programs offered by Oregon's community colleges to address the state's needs in these high-wage, high-demand health occupations. We've also included enrollment data from the 2007-2008 academic year. As you can see, despite considerable efforts and expansions, the projected demand outstrips supply in all but one program area, which is LPN. There are several reasons that we are not able to meet demand. The two primary roadblocks are lack of resources and lack of faculty. Community colleges have capacity issues in their healthcare occupation programs. Currently, most community colleges can accept only 10 to 25% of the qualified applicants into their associate degree nursing programs, and between 20 to 30% of qualified applicants into allied health programs. So our wait lists are very long. The majority of health occupation education programs are clustered in the community colleges that serve the I-5 corridor. Populations in Oregon's rural and frontier areas are insufficient to support the development of local specific independent health occupation programs despite regional workforce needs. There is a lack of technology infrastructure, local site technology, technology support, student support services, and program development for the delivery of allied health and nursing instruction via distance learning strategies to rural and underserved areas in the state. Finally, there is a severe shortage of qualified instructors in nursing and allied health at classrooms and clinical levels and of preceptors in work and training sites. So we're just reinforcing what you're already hearing from other speakers today.
Yes, Senator
Morrison.
Thank you very much. Do we get many nurses, for instance, from out of the country who come to Oregon to practice?
We're not experiencing that.
Okay, because some states are. California
yes.
does.
Okay. I worked at a college in California where we had a large program for bringing nurses from other countries up to board level.
Okay.
But that isn't happening as far as I'm aware.
Oh, now, these are nurses who are qualified to practice in another country, but
yes.
have to be brought up to...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you.
Primarily Filipino.
Yes,
In Southern California, that's the population.
Yeah.
And they have the advantage of being bilingual, too, so there's a double win there.
So they can do it and we can't, right?
Well, I don't think...
as far as training.
I mean, you need the population of Filipino nurses coming to your state and...
Yeah, okay.
They're
some countries don't have a big defense budget, so they can concentrate on doing health care instead.
Yes.
That's the way it works.
That was actually one of my comments coming
yes,
up.
Yes, okay.
Finally, there's a shortage of qualified instructors. For example, in the area of nursing, as of June of 2006, nursing schools in Oregon report that they presently had 16 unfilled positions, that their anticipated recruitment needs in the next 2 years was 56 nursing faculty, and that they anticipate 36 additional nurses will retire in the next 3 to 5 years. That's 92 additional nursing faculty in the next 5 years. Faculty must be prepared at the master's and doctoral level. So what are we doing to address this problem?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Yes.
May I ask a question here?
Yes.
One of the things I've heard is a complaint from many nurses who have 30 or 40 years in the field
yes.
and know more than any masters or doctors and
yes.
nurses could ever possibly gain from that experience is they're not allowed to teach. And they would very much like to teach, and they think they have a lot to impart, and yet because they haven't got a master's or a doctor's degree, they've only been in the field for 30 or 40 years, they're not allowed to.
Yes.
Could the state change that, or is that something that's done by accreditation nationally or state?
I think we would suffer our accreditation if we did that. But I would really encourage us to look at the pipeline for helping those nurses in feasible ways to get their master's degree over their 30 or 40
year
career.
That was my follow-up question. Could you offer a one-year program for them to get their master's degree, and would that qualify them for teaching?
I think that should be some study about some creative models that take our ADN graduates who are practicing nurses, most of the nurses in the state, and helps them go through our public university system to complete a master's using distance learning and creative strategies, and I think that that conversation would be really worthwhile.
Dr. Campbell, I think, is going to address that in your presentation, are you? Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, let me follow up. I think the idea that we have a lack of faculty for nursing programs is a fallacy. I think it's been put in place by institutions involved, and they're more interested in seat time and master degrees and doctorate degrees than in real people who can really teach. And my experience has been as a physician that nurses coming out of practical programs are much more effective than those coming out of 4 or 5 year programs. They have a lot of seat time and no actual clinical experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm just making this on the record. I think we have a huge reservoir of very, very competent nurses who have huge experience, which we've turned our backs on. And I've been talking about this for 4 or 5 years, and we've done this in other fields. We have many programs at the community at higher education levels for people who have a bachelor's degree, do a 1 year program in teaching, and become excellent teachers in K-12 programs and others. We have a huge reservoir of well educated nurses who have a huge wealth of information, and would probably be better instructors than anybody you could get out of a PhD or a master's program, and we've turned our back on these people. They've come to me over and over again, said, I love to teach. I've been in the field for 30 years. I've been an ICU nurse for 30 years, and I have no way of being allowed to teach. And so I just can't accept the idea that we have a shortage of faculty. I think we have a shortage of an ability to get people accredited so they can teach, and I would offer that as a real challenge for us to do.
Okay. Under the current system and with the current requirements, we can't hire enough nursing faculty. And we also can't pay them anything close to what they get when they work in the hospital.
Follow up. They're not interested in working in the hospital anymore. They got 3 years experience. Right. They're in their late 50s, early 60s. They love to teach. Mm-hmm. They would love to do that. They come to me all the time and ask, how can I make this happen? And I don't see us stepping up as institutions saying, we're going to develop a 1 year program for a master's degree and get those people in as faculty. Right. I've heard this now for 6 years. It's time to step up and do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think there's a collective bargaining issue with faculty salaries at community colleges that has to be addressed.
So, continue.
One of the reasons that I came here this morning was to share how LBCC has worked with other colleagues and other community colleges to develop a delivery model for radiological technology, which is also called diagnostic imaging, using distance education. And we've also used that model to develop a polysomnography program, which as sleep lab technician, which means that we serve the state as the lead college, but students in rural communities are able to take part of this program. By working together, we have better used our limited resources and reduced the cost of having to create new programs at every college. Students in rural Oregon can access this program and start rewarding careers in their hometowns. The LBCC Diagnostic Imaging Program served as a model that was integrated into the Healthcare Workforce Initiative, funded by the legislature for the 2007-2009 biennium, and is being expanded to other allied health programs, including certified nursing assistant, licensed practical nurse, pharmacy tech, physical therapy assistant. Using a statewide approach, we were able to build a program that reaches all regions of the state. Students in areas that have a need but don't have enough students to fill the whole classroom are now able to access this program using distance education technology. And I'm frequently told by presidents in rural Oregon that they are very grateful for this program because it means the one or two students that they have at their college who are interested in being a diagnostic imaging technician can partake in this program and not only complete their degree goal, but they stay in the community and they don't relocate to a major metropolitan area. This healthcare workforce initiative focuses on implementing healthcare workforce education programs through improved access, transferability, and articulation across all 17 community colleges and our higher education partners, particularly OIT and OHSU.
We appreciate the legislature's financial support of this initiative and believe with additional resources we could expand this initiative even more. And, for example, we have just recently expanded it into polysomnography. Community colleges are also doing more to partner with the healthcare providers and industry partners in our area. LBCC, for example, Samaritan Health Services makes a significant annual contribution to LBCC that allows us to add 18 additional nursing students to our program every year. With additional state support that community colleges received in this biennium, LBCC began matching their contribution, thus expanding our nursing class by a total of 36 additional students. We have interpreted the word partnership to mean that both parties contribute to the greater good. So that was because of the increase that we received in this particular biennium. A good chunk of that went towards expanding our nursing program. We understand the difficult budget situation that you face and that we face. Our students and colleges are feeling the economic downturn too. However, we must continue to ensure that financial resources are available to address these projected health professions' workforce shortages. Nursing programs cannot stop and start on a dime, nor contract and expand on a dime. It takes time to expand programs, and the pipeline for qualified students is 2 years after the completion of their prerequisite. Oregon's community colleges encourage you to keep the pipeline as wide open as possible. And that would include for nursing faculty, too.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions? And Ann is very good about answering questions about how that RadTech program works across the state.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Dr. Campbell from the Oregon Center for Nursing, Executive Director.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I am Chris Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I'm pleased to be able to share with you the status of the nursing workforce in this state and some of the work that we are doing to improve things. So the Oregon Center for Nursing, just a little background, was created in 2002 by the nursing leaders in the state of Oregon in response to the impending nursing shortage. We are a 501c3 organization, and we are supported by grants, fundraising, and now with some money from you through Senate Bill 4, our nursing shortage bill last session. We are facing a nursing shortage, and it's an impending severe nursing shortage. We have a little reprieve with the economics, but it's approaching, and the nursing community in the state has been aggressively working to mitigate the effects of not having enough nurses since 2002 when we created the Center for Nursing. Some of the work that we have done, and we've been bold, we have we set out to double enrollments in our schools of nursing, and we have done that. Statewide, we are graduating twice as many nurses as we had been in 2001. And that's a huge success story. We are also providing quality, top-notch nursing education in this state. Oregon rates number one for the NCLEX pass rate exams. So we produce quality nurses here who provide quality health care. We've developed a number of programs to support that program expansion, and we heard Dr. Hopkins-Powell talk about the difficulty placing students in clinical settings to get their clinical experiences. We have developed a regional clinical placement program, which is a process and a software program to centralize the placement of nursing students in clinical settings. We've been working on this for 5 years now. So instead of each hospital, long-term care setting, public health setting, and each school having to coordinate all with each other, we have it all done centralized, each reporting only to one person, our program director for the Student Max program, and it's all done web-based now. So we've increased the use of clinical placement sites by about 30% doing that, and significantly reduced clinician time and faculty time in having to arrange those. So we've also sold that license to 11 other states and are creating a national forum for how to centralize placement and maximize clinical teaching opportunities for students. And that helps us maintain that program, those license fees. We also developed the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, and I expect that OHSU will tell you a little bit more about that, but that's a huge success story too. We're facing a huge faculty shortage, and what the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education does is it's a community college OHSU partnership with a shared curriculum, one application, dual enrollment, community college and OHSU. It is making baccalaureate education available to students in the community college setting. They can finish in 4 years rather than, it can sometimes be difficult to get through the nursing programs in 4 years. And it builds that pipeline for graduate education so we can get our nurses with baccalaureate degrees into graduate schools. It builds that. We have 60% of our nurses in Oregon have associate degrees. We are graduating now, since we've increased capacity, 50% baccalaureate and 50% associate degree nurses. That's a success story because we need them to get into graduate school for not just faculty, but for advanced practice roles, our nurse practitioners, our nurse anesthetists, and also for our nurse administrators. Our hospital nurse administrators are masters or doctorally prepared as well.
Thank you. Are the hospitals helping to subsidize nurses' salaries to become faculty at community colleges? I was told by the president of my community college that that was an arrangement they were working on, because there is a limit, you know, the collective bargaining faculty at community colleges is not, the salary is not high enough, and so there has to be a couple of sources. Now, is that happening?
Chairman Sanderson, Senate Morissette, we've had phenomenal partnerships with industry all over the state to support the development of nursing students and nursing faculty. So, yes, I believe Salem Hospital has helped pay for a faculty for Lynn Benton. The Providence Health System has invested heavily in the University of Portland and VA to help the VA and the Providence Health System to help University of Portland with their nursing program, which they have tripled since we began our mission to double enrollments in the schools of nursing.
Peace Health, I think, in Lane County was a hospital that the president was talking about also. But I think that's wonderful because
it's all over the state. It's happening. Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon. Industry has really stepped up to the plate, not just with faculty, but also with some money and with working with the clinicians to help them with all the extra student load. So we could not have ever done this doubling of enrollment without the significant investment of industry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to get on the record again. I think that you're, first I want to thank you for the work you've done. You've doubled enrollment. That's an amazing process. And you've done it, from what I can tell, without losing quality. But I also think it's unsustainable. You're going to exhaust your faculty, and you're going to exhaust your resources. But I appreciate what you've done.
Oh, okay. Senator Manus Anderson and Senator Bates, that is exactly the point. We have doubled enrollment with only 20% more faculty. It is totally unsustainable. And that is why our huge effort right now is to, we are developing a strategic plan to solve the faculty shortage, and I do believe there is a faculty shortage. We just did a faculty survey, the Oregon Center for Nursing did, which is at the graphic artist right now, so it'll be printed shortly, and we will share that with you. But I have some of that information for you. The faculty shortage is real. They're on average older than the average nurses. Average faculty in Oregon's 52. Average age of the nurse is 48. So the nursing shortage, the faculty shortage are working together. It's more immediate with the faculty, and the additional education requirements make that more of an emergency.
Madam Chair.
And go ahead. Yes.
I think we both want to speak, and I suppose I should let, I would like to let her finish, and then I want to offer an alternative way of dealing with this problem.
And Senator Montes-Anderson and Senator Bates, I would like to say also that the Oregon State, and in regard to the comments that you made earlier, because the Oregon State Board of Nursing did revise some of their rules about faculty. Not all faculty have to have PhDs and masters, though most of them do. But we also now have clinical teaching associates. So what we have done a lot in this state is we have done preceptor development. OHSU has done preceptor development. The Hartford Center up at OHSU has been doing preceptor development in long-term care settings. And that's to build the competencies of practicing nurses to be able to teach students in the clinical setting. We believe we need to use the wisdom of those experienced and dedicated nurses. But there are differences in teaching nursing and doing nursing. And in, we want them to be able to have the knowledge for teaching the curriculum, for understanding how it's all developed and how it all ties together. We do have a Master's in Nursing Education program. OHSU, I'm sure, will tell you about that again. And there is also the Western Governors University, which has a Master's in Nursing Education that is totally online and pretty cost-effective for graduate education. So we are encouraging and trying to help nurses get into those programs so we can have faculty. I think the other thing about nurses who have been working in practice for 30 years who really want to teach and would love to teach, there are two things that do disincent them to do that, and one of those is the salaries are different, and it's a different climate now. And the other thing is I think they think it's a lot easier to teach and that it's not going to be as grueling, as physically demanding as working in practice. And faculty, as you can see, we have doubled enrollment with only 10% more faculty. It's no longer the situation that they work a regular day, have evenings, weekends, holidays off. They are working evenings, weekends, holidays in order to educate those students. So I think there's a little bit of the grass is greener on the other side, because nursing practice is so physically demanding, and nursing, being a nursing faculty, is really pretty demanding too. So I would put that on the table too. So our faculty retirements. About half of our faculty, this is the OCN survey, and we collaborate with the Oregon State Board of Nursing. They collect data. We collect the data they don't collect, and then we put it all together in our reports. About half of them are expected to retire by 2025. In addition, we already have 18 vacant positions, faculty positions in schools of nursing, and they are now recruiting for about 50 nursing positions based on those vacancies and projected vacancies. So we are already short.
Yeah, absolutely.
To underscore the need for those faculty, we've doubled enrollment, but within the by 2020, 11,000 of our nurses are going to be retiring from the nursing workforce. Okay. Even if we could get all of those 30-year nurses into faculty positions, it's a short-term fix, because if they've been working for 30 years, they're going to be retiring within the next 10 anyway. So we really have to be building that pipeline. The demand, as Dr. Iskrig showed you, is significant for healthcare. So we are projecting 14,000 new positions for nurses that will be required by 2016. So that means doubling the number of students we are already producing, which is a significant issue. We cannot do that without faculty. So our huge focus right now is building the faculty workforce that we need to do to meet this mission. Our solutions at OCN, We've done lots of things to support program expansion, and to we're doing leadership development to retain nurses and to build leadership competencies for nurses in practice. We've done a leadership and management and long-term care certification course for directors of nursing service and long-term care. Huge turnover there, so we're trying to mitigate that so we can keep those nurses in practice. But what we really need to do, we also have a diversity initiative, is to get nurses into faculty positions. As has been pointed out, the salary is lower. The average salary of a nurse faculty in the state is $57,000. Average salary of a registered nurse, that's for Oregon, for the 2008 statistics is $68,900, so there's a significant difference. There was a question earlier about recruiting from other states. That's a challenge for Oregon. Our salaries are on average lower than faculty salaries in other parts of the country, and yet our cost of living is significantly higher. One of the new faculty at Linfield College, for example, took a 20% pay cut, and the cost of living is 40% more, and she's a little strapped. So that's an issue. The other question that you had was about bringing in foreign nurses. We have a program in Oregon called Workforce Improvement for Immigrant Nurses. It's at Clackamas Community College. That program takes nurses who were nurses in other countries, who are living in the United States and have been here living and working, and prepares them to take the registration exam in Oregon. They have a huge success rate. So we're not bringing them from other countries. We are taking people who are already here. So they are preparing them to take the registration exams, and that's hugely successful, and they are putting those nurses to practice in all parts of the state, and many of them serve in places that we really need them to be, which is public health and long-term care. The University of Washington in Vancouver, Washington State University in Vancouver, is developing a faculty program to encourage those nurses to become faculty. So they're doing a partnership with the WIN program to get those diverse faculty, those nurses to become faculty, so we can draw in more underrepresented nurses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do we pay travelers compared to our own nurses?
Travelers generally make more money. That's one of the reasons it's such a huge industry right now, is because they can make a lot of money. The problem with using a lot of travelers, though, is that they are not your permanent staff. So they may not be in it for the long haul. So that creates a lot of churn, which can affect the quality of the patient care that is delivered. And I think that they also, they don't participate in committees to help make things better. They're there to do the work. I believe the use of travelers is down now because of the hit with the economy now. Nurses are working more, and more nurses have come back into the workforce. So as we heard earlier, there are some slowdowns. Healthcare is a business, just like all of the other businesses. So there is some slowdown. So I don't think there's quite as many travelers, but the use of travelers has been significant, and the cost of them is significant.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The figure you gave for nurses' salaries is lower than I thought it would be. Is there a breakdown, for example, those who, hospital nurses, assisted living? I mean, do you have breakdowns like that as to where they're practicing as to the salary differential? Because
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, there is information like that. The broad one is from the wage report that the Employment Department does every year. We do know that hospital nurses make the most,
right,
and specialty hospital nurses make the most. So critical care nurses make more than medical surgical nurses. We do know that nurses in long-term care and public health and community-based care make much less than.
Right.
And I will have to check if we have those breakdowns from the Employment Department. I don't believe it's broken down in that way.
Okay. I guess, Madam Chair, it's just perspective of, you know, obviously we need more nurses, but it'd be also interesting to know where the gaps are, and I have a feeling that obviously training is, or the amount of time you got to spend in school is clearly one of the issues, but we may find we have some real gaps in specific areas that might need to be addressed, so...
I do believe that's true. There are differences in pay. There's differences in the pace of work and the workload and people's preferences for the populations they want to serve, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So, but our focus now is really on building faculty. We know that pay is the number one barrier to getting nurses into faculty positions because it's lower than the practicing nurses are significantly. And I spoke with one young woman who is in a master's program. She wants to teach. She's an assistant head nurse at Providence, Portland. She is making $90,000, so leadership roles make a little bit more. She is teaching as part of her student work, and she would love to teach, but and she was offered a position for $45,000. That's a half. Mm-hmm. That's a huge pay cut. She said, "I want to teach. I love to teach. I will continue to work with all the students I can in the healthcare setting that I'm in." She said, "But I cannot take a faculty position because it's too big a hit for my family."
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a personal story. My sister-in-law was on the nursing faculty at Umpqua Community College, and my brother sells real estate.
Used to.
So she quit. She quit doing that because strictly because of income issues. Because my brother's income has dwindled significantly over the last couple of years. So she went out in the private sector simply as a matter of economics. So.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I think that goes back to the comment about nurses being laid off. The healthcare industry still is pretty viable, but there's lots more people working, going back to work, or working more hours. And that's a real challenge now for our faculty, because we're not going to get all these nurses if we don't have faculty. So loan repayment would help tremendously, at least to mitigate the effects. That young woman that I spoke about has $21,000 in loans. And I offered our scholarship fund that we had from the Promise of Nursing event, but she's too late for that because she's graduating this spring. So loan repayment would get them into seats. We could encourage nurses from other states to come because as long as they're in a nursing faculty position, they can get the loan repayment $10,000 a year up to that, if that would work, and that would at least mitigate the effects of paying for school and then taking a lower salary. We are working, the Oregon Center for Nursing, with a pretty large collaborative team of folks from throughout the state. We have we have great representation from Southern Oregon, actually. They have their own coalition working on the nursing workforce, so we work together on that to develop appropriate workload models, formulas for nursing faculty so there's some equity and we don't have people going from one program to another. For those reasons, we want to stabilize the workforce that we have. And we also want to be able to incent people to teach. We've had the example of Dr. Warner from the University of Portland talked about having a faculty come to teach for a year and said, I can't work this hard. I'm going back to my clinical job. This is just too much. So we need to work on the faculty workload and support the nurses and those faculty in every way that they can, particularly the full-time faculty who have been working so hard to expand program capacity. We have a lot more adjunct faculty, too, but they're not involved in the curriculum development and all the committees that make the faculty work move along. And we are also, we're going to address the faculty salary issues, and we're not quite sure how we're going to do that, but we've taken bold measures and figured out innovative solutions, and so we know that will probably be a public-private partnership, however we do that, but it must be addressed in order to sustain the nursing workforce that we need in this state. We are also working to diversify the nursing workforce and our nursing faculty workforce. We need more diverse faculty in order to get more diverse students and more diverse nurses to provide the care that and hopefully decrease health disparities. So
while you're pausing, what do you feel has the Oregon Center for Nursing taken on the problem of finding clinical sites for the healthcare professions, or for nursing in particular?
Chair Monis Anderson, that is our Student Max program for finding clinical sites. That started with they've been doing this for 5 years now. It's really a gold standard in collaboration. It's an educator from every one of the nursing programs in Oregon and Southwest Washington, and the nurse educator from every hospital in Portland, Oregon, or in the Portland metro area in Southwest Washington, as well as long-term care representatives and community-based partners and public health representatives, and they meet once a month to coordinate clinical placement of nursing students. So we share all of those clinical placements, and then it is all handled through this web-based program with the program director from the Oregon Center for Nursing, who coordinates it all and makes sure everybody gets their placements.
But what I'm hearing, at least from Dr. Isgrig, is there is a huge concern, and I was wondering what, if it is successful. Well, I know that Linfield was always having an issue. They would always place nurses in Clackamas County Public Health, where I was a manager, and so I would coordinate that, especially in our immunization programs. But and Walla Walla are having problems too. So I know that program you say exists, but is it meeting the needs of all of the educational institutions?
Chairman Anderson, I believe it is in the Portland metro area. That doesn't mean there aren't challenges, but at least within the nursing community, we are coordinating all of those. But it's still tight. It's still a challenge, and that's why we hired someone to find those. And we're also extending. The biggest challenge is in acute care. So we have really expanded to long-term care, to community-based, to public health, to be creative about. And we also know, as was pointed out earlier, the clinical experiences that you have may help you build your relationship with students so that we can get more registered nurses in long-term care and public health, because they are, on average, older than the hospital nurses are, and they have even bigger shortages. Public health, 66% of the nurses in Multnomah County Public Health are over 50, so that's bigger than the statewide average. So we really need to be replacing them. So, yes, Linfield is participating. Walla Walla is participating. They are all part of that. In fact, Walla Walla, one of the nurses from Walla Walla College, that was her doctoral or her master's thesis to set that up.
Senator Bates and then Senator Morissette.
Dr. Campbell, thank you for coming this morning. At times, I don't communicate well and don't listen well. I'm working on those skills. Not very successfully, unfortunately, sometimes. I think I've heard you today. I don't think I've communicated with you all today, and I would look forward to talking to you outside of this venue and talk about some issues. What I've heard, I believe, is that your biggest concern is faculty.
Yes, sir. Right.
What I've heard also is that you're worried about the aging of the faculty and the cost or the lack of salary support for those people.
Yes, sir.
And everything that I see and think of my field of medicine, which is I'm a practicing physician primarily and senator secondary, is that your approach to this is too limited, and that you could open this up tremendously if you go the direction I've suggested, which is taking on a program, a robust program, or bringing people in, obtaining a master's program after 20 or 30 years of service, and actual hands-on care and experience, and the wisdom of those nurses is something you cannot produce in an academic program. And I would ask that we have a conversation about that at a later time. I don't want to talk to you about it right now. I really am not convinced that, having hopefully listened to you carefully, that the faculty program cannot be resolved in a rather expeditious way and rather easily by tapping into this huge wealth of people we have who are willing to work at either no wages or limited wages because they're older and financially can afford that. They're not worried about raising families anymore, have a huge wealth of knowledge for us, and are anxious to do so. I believe that our chair here probably could teach very well in a public health program. I also believe she would not qualify under your present rules. I may be wrong about that.
That's true.
And I would also guess, and I'm just using her as an example, nothing personal, that she would probably do that no salary or very reduced salary and would love to do that.
Anything would be better than a legislator's salary.
That's right. And I think that there's a huge reservoir out there that we are unaware of. And now my information is very anecdotal and may be incorrect, and I tell you that right up front. Mm-hmm. But I would love, Dr. Campbell, to have that conversation with you sort of on the side over here and see if we can talk about opening that kind of a program up. Other fields have done it. Some of our best teaching that occurs in the medical field for physicians is by older semi-retired physicians or even retired physicians who do it at a basis of volunteering. And the information they can give to people is really amazing. So I'd ask you to think about that as part of your program, not the whole program, part of the program. I'd love to have that conversation with you.
There is some of that going on, and I would welcome that that conversation as well. And I believe that there are probably others in this audience who would like to participate in it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Thank you, Madam Chair, for putting up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm Senator Morset.
I'd like to revisit the idea of our the discussion of the different pay levels for different categories of nurses, and I would really be interested in seeing that, if there's any way of compiling that. This ballpark figure, the difference between a long-term care nurse or, just
ICU nurse.
I know there are a lot of different categories, but people choose what they want to do, not so much partly because of the money, but some people want to be in the long-term care field and are willing to make the sacrifice, but I'm kind of curious about the different levels.
I will see what I can find out about that and get back to you. And my sense is that to the committee chair. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I can survey the leadership in those different sectors and get ballpark figures
too. That would be good information.
So, if we don't already have it, we might have that in our data.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the final question is, how can we help? Are you at the point in your broad thinking and your planning to advance something that would be implemented or enhanced through legislative action?
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Boris, thank you so much for asking that question. Yes, you can help us. We do need loan repayment to get nurses in faculty positions. That will help them get through it. We'll work on scholarships to support them, but the loan repayment would help significantly to get nurses into faculty positions in Oregon right now because they're short. We will work on retention of nurses then so that we can keep them in those faculty positions, but we need some incentive to help offset their graduate education. And the other thing is funding for the Center for Nursing, because the Center for Nursing has brought in over $1 million for all the different programs that we have been doing in the last couple of years. With the funding, and the funding from Senate Bill 4 last session made a huge difference because that gave us operations funding. All of that money pays for a specific, the money that we brought in by grants and fundraising, primarily grants, goes to the programs that we are doing, the leadership, our diversity programs, the capacity building. It doesn't pay for me to coordinate all of that, to get all of the work going, so the operations funding for the Center for Nursing is significant and would be tremendously appreciated.
Okay. We need to move on. Thank you, Dr. Campbell, so much, and I know we will be contacting you again.
Thank you very much, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay. With that, I'd like to call Dr. Halleck, Leslie Halleck, Provost from Oregon Health and Science University. An entourage, if you want an entourage.
Chairman Senator Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm not sure it's an entourage, but I do have the pleasure of introducing to you, my name's Leslie Halleck for the record, and I'm the provost at Oregon Health and Science University. And I have beside me our new Dean of Nursing, Dr. Michael Bly, who joined OHSU last summer and can provide some comments on nursing in the course
Dr.
of my
who?
Presentation. Bly, B-L-E-I. G-H?
C-H.
And he has joined us and has some unique qualifications because he has, he's doctorally prepared in public health as well as having held both an associate dean position in nursing and a chair in a school of medicine and health policy in Kansas, and in addition has extensive hospital practice and practice leadership experience. So he's already infused much of that wisdom into some of the things that are going on at OHSU, and I'll come back to that. Let me just cue these up. A handout that I think you have in front of you, and I'm not going to go through it slide by slide because much of what you've done, you've heard, covers the introduction. Do you all have the handout?
Yes.
And so the case for the shortage you've already heard in terms of the demographics, and or the Northwest has very short lengths of stay in hospitals already. They've pressed that down, and so better than anywhere else in the country if you deem that a plus. Now, some do and some don't. But as we age, people spend more time in hospitals, and as the baby boomers are upon us, that need is growing, and the aging cohorts of providers are sort of exacerbating the problem we face. What I want to do is spend a few minutes talking about other providers, and then I'll turn back to Dr. Bly about nursing because we haven't heard as much about the physicians and dentists. And the physician workforce is aging too. This is an old slide now, but you can see the trend over that 20-year period, and that has continued dramatically in terms of the average age of physicians. Much the same story. You've heard in nursing, they're baby boomers too, and that's a problem. And you heard from Joe Isbrig some of the data challenges we have in the Northwest and in Oregon in particular, and that we really don't know of the licensed practitioners who's actually practicing and how much, and that's a tremendous disadvantage. But we certainly know from other kinds of data that there are shortage areas that are much more acute than others. And the dental community, and I won't go through the exact details, but it's really the same story. Aging population, and in both medicine and dentistry across the country, the production has been flat for 30 years. So the capacity to train physicians and dentists, in recent years, dentists have grown just a little bit, but physicians have just begun to recognize in a policy, national policy way, the desperate need to expand those training institutions. And you're going to see those begin to grow now, but it's, of course, a long time to train a practitioner. The other thing I want to point out...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Bates.
Just two quick comments here. One... there was a study in the middle and late 1990s that indicated we were having excess of physicians, so programs were turned off, and we're getting those programs turned on.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And that really hurt the situation, and the federal government has still been slow turning some of those programs on through the Medicare plan for residency. So it's a real huge problem. I hope you comment on that.
Senator Bates, thank you, and Chairman Amonis Anderson, thank you very much for that question. You're absolutely right, of course, that some of those shortage projections that came along in the late 80s and early 90s had to do with misinterpreting what was happening in managed care and primary care and making predictions from it that have proven to be just completely wrong. And you're right, it took a long time to turn that battleship back around. In the course of the Medicare reimbursement mechanism, which is a kind of odd thing, and this group's a very sophisticated group when it comes to health care, but the way residents are funded in most health systems is on top of their Medicare reimbursement. And those are capped so that institutions who train residents can't increase, if they've had resident training programs, can't increase that number, partly as a result of that very phenomenon. And so we, for example, have almost 40% over our cap, which means we have to subsidize those. We can no longer afford to do that, and so there's tremendous pressure on our residency training capacity as there is across the state. So that's a problem. I think the other thing I want to make sure that you kind of take home, and is, I guess it's the fifth dash under that first bullet, is the apprenticeship model. And Sarah Hopkins Powell brought this up to you before, as well as have others. Healthcare providers have been trained in a pretty old-fashioned way for a century, and it's only the last few years that that's fundamentally changing, and it is changing very rapidly in the last 5 years with the advent of simulation that providers are beginning to trust and think has real value, and the incorporation of that allows a more efficient teaching model. But the other thing that's happening, because the shortage is beginning to be felt in the practitioners' arenas, they're more willing to take apprentices, they're more willing to take these clinical training sites. So in some areas, it's still a big log jam, as Dr. Hopkins-Powell mentioned, and I'd say PAs are in that category. For physicians, in our experience, that isn't our bottleneck. We're working with the dental community to develop models to put dental students into private practices to enhance the clinical training capacity of the state using private practitioners. And it is possible to develop those. It's the coordination that OCN does for nursing is invaluable. And we have an advantage in the physician and dental training arena in that we're the only provider, and so we can provide some of that coordination ourselves. But it is a tremendous need, and I think I'm certainly prompted by listening to my colleague at Pacific to talk to her about some of the other things we might be coordinating, such as the PA program placements, because there you do run into trouble, partly because picture a practice, especially not a smallish practice, that may take a medical student or two, a PA or two, maybe a nurse practitioner. They just get full of student learners who are wonderful to have around, but they do take a lot of time and attention. Mm-hmm. So trying to figure out ways around that.
Dr. Bates?
I'm sorry.
I don't mean to slow us down. I'm going to be a little bit.
I asked our administrator. We'll go till 10.
Are we okay?
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I just heard you correctly. The bottleneck for training physicians and dentists is not faculty. Now, if I heard you correctly, is that what you said? I think you're right. But
it's
not clinical
training sites.
Okay, so I want to make sure I heard that correctly.
Right. I would distinguish between faculty and clinical training sites. The faculty that serve as clinical preceptors are not our bottleneck. The didactic component is a rate-limiting step for us still in terms of the training before they go out into those rotations. And frankly, the clinical training site location is a bottleneck. For in the physician training arena, in the last session, you were kind enough to give us a one-time infusion of support to get our class size from 100 to 120. But to sustain that in a distributed model takes resources to coordinate those clinical sites. We can do it closer to home more cost-effectively because we can use folks in the faculty. But so, yes and no. The actual preceptors are not a bottleneck for physician training. So practices are, we have an actual excess of practices willing to take them. But what is short are the teachers that are required by accreditation to coordinate those sites, to visit those sites, to make sure those preceptors are trained and able to do the evaluations and meet all the requirements. It's not a huge burden, but there is a faculty capacity issue there.
And I just want to bring this forward a little bit, if I could, because I think there's a parallel here. I'm going to go back to the nursing shortage again. I'm one of those preceptors, okay? I don't have a master's in education or a PhD in education, and I've been looked at to make sure I'm teaching what I'm supposed to be teaching. Hopefully I am. In the medical field, as far as physicians are concerned, if we had the restrictions on physicians to teach our young colleagues coming up that the nursing profession apparently has, I may be wrong, we would have a heck of a problem on our hands right now. And what we do in our field, and amongst physicians, is we take what we hope is our best and brightest and those who have the most experience, and we teach the young physicians coming up. But if you required us all to get a master's in this, online or otherwise, we would have a heck of a time. And I would offer that the very best teachers we have as physicians are those who've been around for a while. And we got a lot of physicians in their 50s and 60s who do teach, and are happy to teach, and it's sort of the crown of their career. They've been in practice for a long time, and they love going back and offering a chance to impart that knowledge and wisdom to younger physicians. And then the younger physicians are very open to it. So I just see a parallel there that I just see resistance from in nursing, and I just don't get it.
Well, I'm going to let Dr. Bly respond, but I want to thank you very publicly for the mentorship you've provided, and by sort of using you, all of the practices that do, we're increasingly exploring in dentistry, which hasn't really used that model as much, that possibility, and because practices are having a hard time recruiting junior partners because of the shortage, there's a much greater receptivity than there's been in the past, and there's people eager to take those students. But you are doctorally prepared, and so
that's questionable in my case and others. Okay.
So there is that difference, but I'd ask my colleague to make a comment on the nursing.
Well, Senator Bates, I feel your angst. We're talking about one of the most complex work scenarios probably that faces our country, and when you look at the need for the number of nurses in virtually every aspect of health care, from community health to long-term care to acute care, and you look at the nature of the hands-on care that we provide, you look at research in terms of failure to rescue, and the need for, we know that more educated nurses are quicker to pick up on the very symptoms that you're talking about, the wisdom worker as being able to identify and define. I happen to, we're defining one of the most complex issues. There are several things I think at play that fit into this. When you look at the explosion of knowledge that the nurse has to interpret at the bedside, and you look at genomics and what will happen in the next 5 years in the area of genomics, the wisdom worker who's had 30 years in the old paradigm where we taught a range of drugs, for example, a prescription to give, when that becomes personalized and individualized, the wisdom worker has to relearn and start all over again. And the nurse is at the forefront of the knowledge explosion that we're experiencing in the world today. When you look at areas like informatics and what's expected, and to teach our young people who come in with everything, every form of technology, they're not digital natives like we are. They're digital natives. They're not digital naives. And you look at the IT discussion that was held earlier and what's happening. Some of our more experienced nurses are the least wise about using technology as it comes to helping patients in their homes at the bedside who are now technology dependent. I have great respect. I'm the author of a paper funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation called Wisdom at Work. And I have been a major advocate of retaining in nursing wisdom workers, people who have been identified as 50 and higher. In nursing, nationally, I can't speak to Oregon yet, but I can speak nationally, in the next decade, we will lose the majority of our wisdom workers. So even if we put those people to work teaching, we have about 10 years span to capitalize on that. And that's going to create a tsunami of knowledge deficit. And I'm talking about knowledge that comes in all sorts of forms, at the bedside knowledge along with the science of what we're losing. We are in a bad way. And so Dr. Campbell and others have certainly portrayed the concern around faculty and qualified workers. So I share that with you. A paper that will be published in the Journal of Nursing Administration in April that I'm first author on looked at some of our highest performing hospitals to see what we're doing for the mid-careerist and versus the novice nurse. There are virtually no programs that are helping the mid-careerist pick up the wisdom of those older workers exactly as you're describing. So this is a very complex dynamic. Education of the faculty and of nursing is part of the solution. There is simply more knowledge to be had that needs to be translated to the bedside. And we are in a very precarious position in our country. We are the least educated country when it comes to the nursing workforce. The European Union, Philippines, South Africa, Russia all have baccalaureate as the entry level for practice. There is a reason for that. It is because of the complexity of the healthcare system and the dynamics of who we're caring for. And so, you know, we need our wisdom workers. We need those people who have experientially have been there, have been at the side. They are able to put patterns of things together. I use the metaphor of when it comes to driving a car, we give temporary licenses first, we give some didactic training, and then we let them go out and do it for a while. But we have even restricted with that basic license what that means a couple years later. You can start adding now, and we seem to address this issue, but we don't address it in nursing. In some precarious way, we kind of avoid the connection of practice, the connection of knowledge, the connection of what it means to be safe, to deliver safe care versus what it means to deliver optimal care. So I just think you have really captured the essence of where we're at with this, and we've got all these factors that have to come into play in order to solve this very complicated issue. We need to tap the wisdom of those workers. I think you've heard today there are some solutions that we have pushed through. We've got some national accreditation issues, but we also have the emergence of knowledge that is moving us in a direction that is going to take us places we've never dreamed of being in the next decade.
In the interest of time, I'm going to skip around a little bit just to punch up about three more points here. I just want to mention that sort of pragmatic issue of the accreditation of the institutions is a federal issue, and so that's something we have to work kind of together on. It isn't something you could fix or I could fix, but all of us working together can develop things like online ability to obtain those credentials more efficiently. I want to make two or three other points that I think are really important. Simulation infrastructure across the state has begun to make it possible to do interdisciplinary training. And we've touched on it in several of the presentations, but when you start thinking about the healthcare system and healthcare reform, the ability of different providers to work together more effectively, even before you start dealing with scope of practice and licensure issues, just getting the team to function really well isn't something that's taught in most educational programs. It's something that people learn the first day on the job, maybe the hard way, but with simulation, it's a very different thing. And if you haven't watched a simulation teaching cohort, I really invite you to come do that because it's incredibly exciting. You can sit behind one-way mirrors and watch these students learn from each other in a team where they learn how to work together effectively in a code situation or in any other situation that you can simulate. So the technology infusion and the interdisciplinary team environments are a huge part of the rapidly changing educational models that make these students better and more effective when they get into these clinical sites, which makes these clinical placements easier because they're just, frankly, less dangerous when they show up. So
Can we strike that from the record?
um, but they're just in better shape to really start moving. The other thing that I think Oregon is truly in the vanguard in doing, and you've heard it mentioned, is this articulation kind of process that's gone on. We dubbed it OCNE, and you all heard a lot about it. You gave us some funding. We've now enrolled students in that. They're not quite graduated yet because we've just started, but it is allowing a tremendous sea change in the opportunities that students face, even in their home locations, to go on to baccalaureate and ultimately graduate degrees. And so in a larger time frame, we can talk about that in a very specific way across the state, and I'd be happy to answer questions. But that's out there. It's rolling. Because of the various cost constraints, one of the things that we're all learning is that hub and spoke models are more efficient than scattered multiple site models. So the community colleges tend to have a hub of the OUS institution in their region as the place that sort of administers and coordinates things. We have gone to a model not just in nursing but in medicine, PA, dentistry, where we use the Area Health Education Centers, the AHECs, as an infrastructure piece for both the delivery of technology, things like video conferencing, but also coordinating housing. And one of the most exciting things that we hear from students who've been out on one of these rotations is we'll have a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment and we'll have multiple kinds of learners living together doing their rotations. So even though you haven't maybe even developed the curriculum to develop those teams, they're learning from each other what they're experiencing out there in the community. So the interdisciplinary housing is actually a useful tool in developing some of these models. The other thing I just leave with you is the input side isn't a problem. There are lots of qualified applicants. I couldn't have said that to you 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It's been true in medicine for quite a long time. It's been true in dentistry gradually. It's now true in nursing. We have lots and lots of qualified applicants. It's capacity to educate them that's rate limiting. And in some fields, this clinical placement issue. I'm just going to say one word because the question came up earlier about funding models. And this is a very simplified view of it. But if you think about OHSU as a very complex institution, a big health system, it has a lot of research. In this diagram, red is healthcare reimbursement and yellow is research grants. The light going on when you discover something was kind of my analogy. But that little bubble up and that little circle up in the right corner is education. And it's really funded about in equal parts in our model by the state appropriation. Even though it's only 2.7% of our total budget, it's about 30% of our educational effort. And tuition, which is now about 40% of that effort, and this is taking everybody in aggregate, and about a third of anything we can find, anything we can cobble together. And that can include philanthropy, federal training grants, and frankly, a subsidy from the health system. So all three of those help do that extra third to make the educational model. And I want to make sure you know that because the state piece is very important to us. There's a direct correlation between tuition levels and the state dollars. We have raised tuition less than we've lost on the state appropriation side, but nonetheless, there's not infinite elasticity there. In some areas, that's more of a problem than others. And I would say in nursing, it's one area where tuition, we are very close to being maxed. We see especially a challenge when these students come through the community college because there's such a big differential. The economy is pressing them, and it's very hard for them to go make the commitment to go on and continue their education when they're facing these big tuition bills. So either the appropriate level of funding or the loan forgiveness that you've heard about are really
how many in your physician training program and probably including your intern how many out of state do you have versus in state? Because what I've heard is some universities tend to want to bring the out-of-state because that actually brings in more tuition dollars.
Right.
And therefore, then, the retention rate, too, is not there because then they go back to wherever they are. So can you give some numbers
sure.
on that?
Chairman Mona Sanderson, thank you for the question. In medicine, we aim for a 70% resident 30% non-resident. Now, you admit, and sometimes you get more, sometimes you get less. That's our goal, and that's about what we have. We do benefit from the larger non-resident tuition. I won't apologize for that. It's a function of the state funding level, and it does help us carry some of the residents and some of the programs. But in Oregon, at OHSU, unlike most states, we have the same retention rate for non-residents that we do for residents, and that's true at the MD level. It's also true at the resident level. And so that's a real plus for us. It's a good place to live, and when the non-residents come here, they're just as apt to stay as our residents are, or another way to put it is a lot of our residents also go elsewhere. Now, so it's about 50% either way, and it doesn't matter whether they were residents or non-residents. In the case of dentistry, we also aim for about 70%. It's a function of the state funding, but that's about what we aim for. And there, the non-residents are a little more apt to leave. And on the other hand, we have, if you look at the dental licenses in this state, about 70% of them were educated at OHSU. We recruit fewer from out of state, but we retain our residents with a very high rate. So what we do when we look at the I call them capitation models of, and really drill down into these educational models, we look at it as if the state appropriation subsidizes that non-resident-resident differential. In other words, it buys down the tuition rate to the resident rate, and none of it is used to support the non-resident student. That's sort of how we work.
We only have a couple of minutes, so I want to focus on what we as a legislature can do to help with the workforce issue. And I'll just throw out one idea. Maybe some others have some ideas also. But, for instance, I have a physician in my district. He's older, and he wants to continue on a very part-time basis being a physician. Yet the malpractice is so costs so much, and so I'm meeting with him next week. Is probably going to say, is there any way that we as a legislature can change some of the malpractice requirements, or who knows what? So those are the types of ideas and suggestions we need our help in helping retain, you know, our healthcare workforce on some of the, especially for those that are older that don't want full-time jobs but definitely want to keep their practice going in a very minimal way.
Chairman Mona Sanderson, that's a huge subject, and it is absolutely a problem. The tort cap reform is an incredibly important aspect of the funding model of OHSU as a whole. The rural, it isn't just rural, but the subsidy of malpractice insurance that was described earlier for particularly OBGYN and family practitioners who deliver babies is incredibly important to keeping those practitioners. We have crises in some of our rural communities where they just don't have anyone who can deliver now because of that challenge. And so that program is going to be examined during the session, and that is a very important thing. I think from the other point of view, though, the sheer ability to sustain the production of physicians in this state is, if you look down the road 5 to 10 years, is going to make or break whether you and I can get health care. And that's really a capacity issue. In the country, there's a huge shortfall. In Oregon, we train half the national average per capita as it is. So sustaining our size and then growing it is another piece of that. But you're right, the practice environment, particularly now that it's uncapped, is not seen as an advantage, and it's making it now harder to fill that gap from half the national average of production of physicians. We've filled it in the past by recruiting them from other states. That's harder now given the liability environment.
So is the reason it's easier for physicians to deliver care to patients overseas, say through the medical teams international, rather than taking care of our underserved population here? Is it solely rests on because of our tort? problems that we have.
I don't
here.
Think, Chairman Melissa Anderson, I don't believe it's just that. I mean, there are people who will spend a week or two, their vacation perhaps, on one of those volunteer activities and may or may not have a liability issue depending on where they're going and what their own personal circumstances are. But it is true that the underserved areas have generally less income that's provided that practice or practitioner, so it's harder to pay those insurance costs. The other thing that affects that, though, is the debt that you've been hearing about. When you have students, the average indebtedness that's well over $200,000, it's harder for them. I always call it a mortgage without a house. If they join a specialty or even a primary care practice in a relatively populated area with reasonable insurance percentages, they can pay those loans. But if they go into an underserved area where they're not always paid in cash, it's much harder. So it is affecting choices. It's reducing the number of primary care entrants. It's reducing the locations where they practice. So it's very relevant.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, we did advance a bill in pre-session filed for a tax credit for physicians focusing on two areas. One is hopefully to influence more people into primary care, that there is a relief mechanism, and the second is to focus on the maldistribution of physicians for those that are willing to go into those areas and to receive this tax credit. And I know this environment is going to be very difficult to think about any tax credits, but in terms of the potential benefit for a pretty small total cumulative tax credit, it could be pretty great benefit. So that is, it will be in our Senate Revenue Committee.
Okay. Good to hear.
Senator Morris and Chairman Mona Sanderson, thank you for the work you've done, and particularly for the rural areas where there's sort of right on the edge of having health care system or not. Those sorts of credits are really critical. And as you know, we have the rural tax credit now, and it really makes a huge difference in recruiting practitioners.
Madam Chair, just real quick, I know we're out of time. This is a discussion that takes a lot more time, and I would look forward to, if we have time to do so, but it's a mixture of a lot of bags here. As far as production of physicians in the state, we have a new medical school potentially come to the state, which will double our production of physicians for the first time since World War II.
Right.
It's going to be a private school if it comes to fruition. The medical malpractice issue is huge for retaining and recruiting physicians in the state. It's something that wouldn't cost us anything to do. It's a matter of having the courage to do it. And that's another tough one. Now, the rural program we have for reimbursing primary care and physicians doing OB and general surgery in those areas has been the most effective tool we've had for retaining and recruiting physicians into those areas. So that needs to be looked at, too. A dozen different things, and they all are important. In context, we can stabilize and enlarge our population in the state. One of the things you have to think about, too, is that having a medical school here does not get you more physicians that start in the state. What works is your residency programs. You'll have a bigger retention of physicians out of your residency programs in the state than you do out of the medical schools. And you know that to be true, too.
Senator Bates, in the case of OHSU, they're the same for us in both cases, retention of medical students and residencies. But certainly in the kind of school that's coming, assuming that it does, there's a huge difference. And so that is going to be the residency issue that we touched on earlier is really critical.
And just to give some cover here for OHSU and our medical school, the retention in our state of medical students in our state versus the number of students we're educating is really no different than any other state. So we're not losing students nor gaining students. Our retention rates are about the same inside the state as other state schools. There's no real significant difference that I know of. Is that correct?
Senator Bates, for residents, it's about the same, but for non-residents, it's higher. We retain a higher percentage than most states.
Yeah, it'd be helpful to have a medical school in a rural area. Yeah. Some states do.
Lebanon is pretty rural.
Well, I mean, that's if you train doctors in a rural area, they may stay in a rural area.
Senator Moore said we do our best to put the students out in those environments, but you're right, it's a cost issue.
He was saying outside the Willamette Valley is what he was trying to get.
We need to adjourn. Thank you. I'm sorry that it's so rushed, but... this conversation is not done. And there's some other things. There are some updates, but we'll do that on Tuesday, 8 o'clock. All right, with that, we're adjourned.